Welcome back to the next module of the Running Linux on Azure Virtual course. In this module, we're going to take a look at how you can use different Azure storage services from within your Linux virtual machine. The first thing we're going to cover today is all the available disk types for a virtual machine and in which scenario each of them is recommended. Then we'll try to create a software RAID array from multiple data disks. This will enable us to have more available disk space on a single drive, as well as improving the performance of that specific drive. And finally, we'll take a look at a dedicated Azure service called Azure Files that allows us to have multiple files shared amongst machines. So let's go through all the available disk types again. I know we've already covered this, but I think it's a pretty good reminder. So in Azure, you have three available disk types. First of all, you have the OS disks. This is the disk that's created when you provision the machine for the first time. This is a persistent disk that resides in Azure storage. We'll take a closer look at what residing in Azure storage means in a few minutes. But what you have to remember is that this disk is persistent. So if you destroy the machine and you recreate it from this disk, everything that's on it should still be there. And that by default, it's mounted in /dev/sda. The second disk is the temporary storage disk. This is part of the storage that's attached to the the physical host you reside on with your virtual machine. And what this means is that as soon as you get moved, your machine gets moved from that physical host, you lose all the data that's in there. That's why it's called a temporary storage disk. Of course, this is not the ideal drive for data you may need in your application. So it's okay if you use your page file in there, or maybe if you use your MySQL, if you put your MySQL temporary tables on there, but please do not put anything that you may need after a machine restart or a machine stop. By default, this is mounted in /dev/sdb. And the third type of disks available to you, and this is probably the ones you'll use more often, is the data disks. Data disks are persistent as well. And they're mounted in /dev/sdc going forward up to 32 letters. The maximum number of data disks you can have per machine is 2 times the number of cores. So for instance, in an A2 machine that has 2 cores, you can mount up to 4 data disks. This is besides your OS disk and temporary storage disk. So for that A2 machine, you can have up to 4 data disks, 1 OS disk and 1 temporary storage disk for a total of 6 disks. Now, when we said that a disk is persistent, what we actually mean is that if something happens to the virtual machine, to the raw compute power you have, you'll still have the data that you store on these disks, and you can start a new machine using these disks. So for instance, let's suppose that we have this virtual machine and it has a disk assigned to it in Microsoft Azure Storage. As you can see, this doesn't mean that your data is in just one place. In the least favorable scenario of redundancy in Azure, you'll have at least 3 copies of your data. So if something happens to your primary replica of the data, Azure will automatically fall back to one of the other replicas. So we have the virtual machine, we have the disk inside Microsoft Azure Storage with its replicas. And let's say that something happens to the virtual machine. Of course, what you see here is that we can also have offsite replicas. These are asynchronous replicas. We'll talk about them in a few minutes. But if something happens to the virtual machine, then a new virtual machine can be spawned in its place with the same disk. And all the data that you stored on those disks will be available to the new virtual machine as well. Of course, this will happen only if you store the data on the OS disk or the data disks. Everything is stored on the temporary disk in /dev/sdb. That's by default mounted in /mnt. Will be erased. Now, one new aspect we didn't talk about in the previous modules is the redundancy available to you in Azure. So there are at least three available replication options. The first one is locally redundant, meaning you for each block of data you write to Azure Storage, meaning to a persistent disk, you have three copies of that data in the same region. This is the lowest level of redundancy you can get in Azure. These are synchronous copies, meaning that every write you perform to the disk will automatically get replicated to the replicas first before returning to the caller. The second replication option is geo-redundant. This has the same three synchronous copies in the same region that you'll get in the locally redundant option, as well as three asynchronous copies in a paired region. What this means is that as soon as the write is performed in the region of origin, you'll also get an asynchronous write performed in a paired region. For instance, the Europe West region is paired with Europe North, and when you perform a write in Europe West on a geo-redundant storage account, that write will also get pushed to the Europe North region, and the same is for Europe North. If your primary region is Europe North, your write will be pushed to Europe West symmetrically. And just about any region in Azure has its pair. If you're interested, you can find it on Azure Storage. You can find this information. The last available replication option is read access geo-redundant. This is the redundancy is about the same as geo-redundant, but what this offers you is an endpoint from which you can perform reads on in real time. So in the geo-redundant case, what actually happens is that if something happens to the data center, to your primary data center, primary region, Azure can fall back to the secondary region and you'll be able to read from that endpoint only after Azure decides to perform the fallback. In the read access geo-redundant case, you will be able to read from the secondary endpoint, so in our case, from the Europe North data center, at any point in time. However, you cannot initiate the fallback, so you'll still have your primary region as, in this case, Europe West, but you'll also have another endpoint available in case the primary endpoint is not available at some point, or in case you want to scale reads. That being said, let's go to the portal and look at the disks for a virtual machine again. We'll be using a virtual machine that we created in a previous module, the Azure PHP O2 machine. As you can see, for this machine we have two disks, the OS disk and data disk. And because this is an A1 machine, which has one core, we'll be able to add a new data disks, and we'll go through this procedure again. So let's just attach an empty disk. We'll call it Azure PHP O2 Data O2, and we'll make it almost 1 terabyte in size. And while the disk is created, let's talk about the host cache options for a moment. Let's go to another machine so I can show you all the options. So when you go to attach empty disk, you'll see there are three options for a host cache for about every disk. First option is none. First of all, what host cache means is just an intermediary cache between your virtual machine and the Azure Storage Service, and this is called a host cache because it resides on the physical host. So the first option for a disk is no host caching. This means that all the reads and writes that you perform are sent straight to Azure Storage and are served from that service. The second option is a read-only cache. With this option enabled, all your writes go to Azure Storage, just like with no host caching. But when it comes to reads, recurring reads have a good chance of being served from the cache, depending on the size of the read, of course, and the number of reads you perform. So if you usually read something like, let's say, 200 megabytes of data very often, most probably those pieces of information will be stored in the read-only cache and will be served straight from the host cache. And the third option, sorry, is the read-write cache. This means that both reads and writes will possibly be cached by the host cache. How this happens is, of course, for reads we've already covered, recurring reads, so reading the one piece of information that's not been read before will go to Azure Storage, and the second time you attempt to read the same piece of information, given that it's in a short interval after the first read, will be served straight from the cache, which usually is a lot faster than reading it straight from Azure Storage. On the other hand, write cache is just, instead of writing straight to Azure Storage, you first write the host cache, and then the host cache takes care of flushing that write to Azure Storage. Now, you might think that it's always a good idea to have read-write cache on. Why would you not? But the truth is that from the benchmarks that a lot of people have performed, myself included, other members of the community, of course, and Microsoft as well, it's not always a performance improvement activating the read-write cache. There's a lot of reasons why this is the case, but we'll just cover some of the scenarios and I'll explain briefly why that is the case. So let's go to the other machine again and look at the host caches for different disks. So we have, as you can see, for the OS disk, we have read-write cache. This is activated by default, and what this is enabled is because from the benchmarks Microsoft performed, apparently the OS disk and the operating system workload is a lot more efficient with this both caching, read and write caching enabled. However, when you create the data disk, the default host cache setting is none. Why? Because there are particular workloads for which host caching is not does not add any performance benefits. There is also one limitation: you cannot have host caching enabled for more than 4 data disks. So, for instance, if you have a machine with 8 cores that can go as high as 16 data disks, you can only enable host caching for 4 of them. Good. Now let's go back to the Azure PHP O2 machine and look at the data disks. Actually, we'll go straight to the machine. By the way, this is something you have probably already seen. So it shows me all the disks I've attached, the type of disk that disk is, the host caching for it, and something we'll talk about in a few moments, where that disk resides in Azure Storage. So apparently there was an issue attaching the disk, telling me that I've created a disk with a similar name before. So let's go ahead and write that delete that disk. And this is great that it happened, because it allows me to show you another tab that's very useful. So if you go to virtual machines, By default, you'll be taken to the instances tab that shows you all the virtual machines you have. However, there's another tab called the disks tab that displays all the disks that you have attached to your virtual machines. And you have, for each disk, you have the name of the disk, whether that disk is attached to a machine or not, if it contains an operating system. If this field is filled in, it means that it's an operating system disk. Otherwise, if it's just a dash like here, it means it's a data disk. And the host cache that's activated for that particular disk. The subscription where the disks are assigned to, and the location in Azure Storage. Now, there is one particular disk in here, this one, that looks a bit different. And that's because this disk is not attached to any machine. It's a data disk, and you can see that it has no setting for host cache. Why this happens is because host caching is something particular to the virtual machine and not to the disk itself. Because, of course, the host cache uses the resources of the physical host. So if you have a disk that's not attached to any virtual machine, it will not have any host caching. You'll have to select the host caching option when you attach the disk to a machine. Now we have this disk. Let's go ahead and attach it to our virtual machine. So we had the Azure PHP O2 machine that we wanted to attach the disk to. You can either go and attach an empty disk, so this is something we've done before, or you can attach an existing disk, and we'll show you all the disks that are not already assigned to a virtual machine. So we have the disk, and of course when you attach the disk, you can select the host caching option. We'll leave it to none for now. Okay, and this should take a few seconds, and afterwards we'll be able to see the disk in the virtual machine. Let's go ahead and issue an lsblk in the machine so we can see the disks. We have the SDA disk, of course, the operating system disk. We have the SDB, the temporary drive that's mounted in /mnt. We also have a data drive that's mounted in /data, and this disk already showed up. This is the disk we've just attached, but it's not a disk we formatted, it's just a disk I created previously, and that contains just about nothing. Okay, let's go ahead and format that disk. If you want to mount a disk to the operating system, to the file system, you first have to format it. We'll go ahead and do that. We'll say we want a new partition. We'll make it the first partition, and we'll just make it use the entire size of the disk, and we'll write the changes back. Now if you issue lsblk again, you will see that for this disk we also have a partition, which is good, and this partition covers the entire drive. Now in order to mount it, we also have to create a file system on top of it. We'll create the next four file system in on that partition in the dev/stdio, the first partition on the disk. It should take a few moments, and afterwards we're ready to mount our disk in a folder that we have to create. Let's create a folder called data2, because we already have a folder called data, and we'll mount that first partition of the SDD drive in data2. There we go. We issue an lsblk again, and as you can see, now we have the drive mounted in a folder. If we go to the data2 folder, you can see it's just something that was created recently. It also contains the default plus the found folder. Now, this is about it for disks. Let's go back to our next topic, which is what's the difference between disks and images in Azure. So now that we've seen the types of disks we can use in Azure, let's sum it up a bit. We have two different disk types, two different persistent disk types for virtual machines. The first one is operating system disks, and the second one is data disks. However, there's one limitation for all disks, and that's that you can only attach a disk to a single virtual machine at a time. A disk can be detached from a machine, the disk can be then reattached to another machine, but at a single point in time, you can only have it attached to one virtual machine. Also, if you want to create a virtual machine from a disk, you can detach that disk from the virtual machine. It has to be an operating system disk, of course, and then you can create a new machine from it. But once you create the machine from that disk will be then attached to the machine, and you'll no longer be able to use it in order to create new machines. If you have that need, if you need to create multiple machines from a single, let's call it OS template, and probably most of you want to do that, there's the concept of operating system images. So these are pretty similar to disks. They hold an operating system as well as different applications or configuration settings, but they allow you to start multiple machines from a single image, and the particular image is not tied to a virtual machine. So you can create a virtual machine from an image, but that image can then be reused. When you create a virtual machine from an image, a disk will be created for that virtual machine, and the image will be basically copied to the disk, and then that disk will just belong to the virtual machine while the image will be independent of it. There are three types of virtual machine images available in Azure, or at least at this point. The first one is Microsoft endorsed images. These are what they call official images. These are the ones you will see in the management portal. They are either created by Microsoft or endorsed by Microsoft. And they are thoroughly tested with each release of Azure. The second, these images are available to all Azure clients in pretty much all regions. The second type of images are the partner provided images. These are images mostly created by the community or by partner companies. They are most of them are checked by Microsoft to work well with Azure, but they're actually hosted in a third party environment called VM Depot. You can also use them from inside the Azure portal. But what you have to keep in mind here is that these are partner provided images. While they are checked by Microsoft, you cannot really consider them official images. The great thing about this repository is that it hosts hundreds of images, so almost every popular software you can think of is provided as an image alongside with your favorite operating system. So for instance, if you like Salesforce CRM, you'll find it in at least six different flavors on different versions of Ubuntu. These images are also available to all Azure clients in all the regions. And the third type of images is user-created images. These are images you create from virtual machines, either virtual machines that you create in Azure or virtual machines that disks that you upload from your on-premises Hyper-V environment. And all the images are particular to your subscription, so this will not be visible to other users. This is either a feature or a limitation, depending on how you want to look at it. It's a feature because it allows you to have your private images. And it's also a limitation because you can only start machines from the images you created in that particular subscription. So if you're managing multiple subscriptions, you'll have to copy the image to each of the subscriptions if you want to use them there. There are two types of images available. One of them is called a generalized image. This is actually the definition of an image. It allows you to create new machines from one OS template, but at the same time it also allows you to change different settings when you start the machine. So for instance, if when you start a new machine from an image, you might want to change the administrator username and password, or you might want to change the DNS server or the host name of the machine. Well, that's called a generalized image. It is a copy of an existing disk, but it also generalizes some of the settings for you, because most probably you don't want to copy those as well. And then there's the second type of images, that's specialized images. These are just exact copies of the disk of a machine, and when you start a new machine, it will just take all the settings from your previous machine, including the root username and password. Yeah. Now let's go and look at how we can manage, create and manage images in Azure. Okay, so we're back in the portal. Let's look at the Microsoft provided images. For that, we'll go to New, Compute Virtual Machine from Gallery. This gallery shows you all the images that are either created or endorsed by Microsoft. And you can see you have the Microsoft ecosystem here with all the Windows Server and Microsoft specific software on top of it. Then you have the Ubuntu family of images, the CoreOS family of images, CentOS, SUSE, Oracle, and Puppet Labs. Let's maybe take a look at one of the categories for Ubuntu, for instance. As you can see, we have three Ubuntu versions available at this point: 12.04, 14.04, and 14.10. One thing you might want to keep in mind is that these are not all the available versions. There are other versions available when you use the command line tools. However, you'll also be able to access more options once you select a version, and when you go to the next page, you'll see the version release date. So if you want to use a particular build of Ubuntu or of other Linux distributions, you will be able to do so by picking another release date from this page. Okay, so these are the Microsoft endorsed images. Let's look at the images that are made available by third party called VM Depot. Again, these are provided by the community. And as you can see, there are literally hundreds of available options, everything you can think of. One thing that I noted here is you can even find older versions of operating systems than the ones you'll find in the Microsoft section. So here we have CentOS images, but you also have a lot of software packages already installed on these images. So for instance, let's go to Drupal, right? So we have Django for the Python lovers, and here we are at Drupal. You have what looks like about 20 versions of Drupal, so anywhere from version 6.33 running on Ubuntu 14.04 all the way up to the latest Drupal 8 beta version. When you select one of these images, what will happen is that this image you selected will be created in will be copied in a storage account of your choice, and then you will have the option of starting machines from this image. Okay, now let's also look at the images you can create as a user. First, we'll look at a specialized image. A specialized image, like I said, is a copy of the machine, meaning it takes all your disks that are attached to a machine, including the operating system disk and all the data disks, so no temporary disk in there. It'll package them as a single image, and then you'll be able to start machines that are almost in every sense identical to the one you cloned. Now let's do that for one of the machines, the one we have running, Azure PHP O2. Let's say capture. When you select capture and the machine is in running mode, what it will do is just perform a snapshot. It only knows how to capture specialized images. So let's call it Azure Linux specialized image, and this is a specialized image of Linux running on Azure. Good. And this will probably take about a minute. And while this loads up, let's go back to disks and take a look at another attribute that we didn't manage to talk about in the past section. So this is the location attribute. Let's actually copy one of these locations and see how you can just go and find the disks in the storage accounts. Sorry, let's try again. There we go. So let's take a look at the URL for this disk. We have, first of all, we have the name of the storage account. So in this storage account, you will be able to find the disks for this machine. And then there's the container. You can look at these as folders. However, you can only have one level of folders inside Azure storage accounts. And then inside this folder, you'll have a VHD blob. This is identical to Hyper-V VHD files. So this disk is stored as a VHD file. What this means is that you can go to a storage account and take this file, download it, and then run it in your Hyper-V environment. Or you can also go the other way around. You can take one of the VHDs from your Hyper-V environment and then push it to Azure. However, that also means that you have to make some changes to your operating system because it has to be prepared to run inside the Azure environment. Okay, let's go to the storage account. And in fact, we should just copy this again so we can find the disk easily. 1 second. Okay. Let's go to the storage accounts and see where we'll find this disk. So the first part is choosing the right storage account. We should look for something called Azure MySQL VM. Okay, so we'll look for Azure MySQL VM. Then we'll go to containers and we'll look for the one called VHDs. There it is. We'll click on it. And then finally, we'll have to look at for this file, Azure PHP 2015-03-21. Okay, we have to scroll down a bit. There it is. And then we have multiple options. We can download this VHD file. We can edit the properties for it. Right, you can see all the metadata for this file here, including the size of the disk. Or you can just delete the disk from here. Please note that when a virtual machine is running, the disk is locked, so you will not be able to change or delete a disk if it's already attached to a virtual machine. Now, let's go back to images. And as you can see, we already have the image created for us. And let's look at the properties. So we have the name of the image as we typed it, as we entered it. And the status of the image, it says that it's available. We can create new virtual machines from the image. The source is the name of the virtual machine from which we created this image. When the image was last updated, what subscription it is on. This is important because remember, you can only start the virtual machine within the same subscription as the image. And of course, the region of the storage account where the image is hosted. Okay, now let's try to create a virtual machine from this image. I won't go through the entire process again because it takes some time, but it's just as creating a new virtual machine from scratch. So we'll have to you will see two new sections in here. The first one is My Images and then My Disks. What you'll find in My Images is all the available, both specialized and generalized images that you have. So My Images is just images that you you created, and My Disks are, you'll find all the operating system disks that are detached from a machine, so those that are not locked in by a machine. Let's go to My Disks. You see there are no items, even though I've created multiple disks. All of them are busy at the moment, they're attached to a machine. And then in My Images, we'll see the image we just created. Let's go through the process a bit, but we won't wait for the machine to be created. You'll have to provide a virtual machine name. Let's call it VM from image. You can select the size, of course. This is very similar to the process of creating a virtual machine from scratch. However, there are a few differences that I'll point out in a moment. Of course, you can create a cloud service. It's basically all the settings you've seen before, and then you can add extensions to the machine. But there is one thing that you've probably noticed in here that's missing, and that's providing the username and password for the root account. That's because Azure detected that this is a specialized image, that this is an image that's just a snapshot of an existing operating system, and it will use the root username and password from the machine we took a snapshot of. There are some other limitations as well. In the cloud services list, you'll only see the cloud services that are within the region your image is in. Also, when it comes to selecting the region you want to deploy your machine in, you'll only see again the region and the virtual networks within the region from the region the image was created in. And the same goes for all the other settings. Now, this is a specialized image, but what happens if I want to create an image that maybe I want to distribute to the community afterwards, or maybe I want to use for starting different types of machines, but I don't want to be locked in with the same credentials? So for that, we'll have to go to the machine and create a generalized version of that machine, and then create an image from it. And that, for that, we'll connect to the Azure PHP machine again. And there's a tool inside each machine you start from an Azure image called WA Agent. This is basically Windows Azure Agent. There's also a setting, a flag called deprovision. When you call this, what will happen is that this tool will delete all the settings that are particular to this image, so that you can generalize it afterwards, and when you create a machine, have different settings like username and password, DNS server, and so forth. Okay, so first we have to go log in as super user. There we go. Okay. It's just two A's, not three. We also made another mistake. It's --- deprovision. So yeah, I want to deprovision now. And it says what changes it will make to the machine. It will delete all the host keys. Remove all the DHCP leases, and also the DNS settings. Okay, once this is done, all you have to do is just stop the machine, shut it down from the portal, and as soon as the machine will be shut down, we'll be able to create a generalized image from it. So let's wait for a couple of minutes and then come back when the machine is stopped. Looks like the machine is now stopped, so let's go ahead and press the capture button again. And as you can see, we already have a new option. It detected that the machine is stopped and that maybe the image we want to create is no longer a specialized image, but a generalized image of that particular operating system. So let's give it another name. We'll call it Azure Linux Generalized Image And this is a generalized image of Linux on Azure. And if you check this button, it will automatically attempt to create a generalized image for you. Otherwise, it will go ahead and create a specialized image just like the one we had previously. Okay, so I'll check it. And it will also warn you that once you create a specialized image from a machine, the machine will be automatically destroyed and you will only be left with the image. So this is okay for us. And let's wait for the image to be created. This should take about 30 seconds to a minute usually. Looks like the image is created. We have the Azure Linux generalized image now available. If we go to instances, the Azure PHP 2 instance is now missing because it was deleted in the process. Let's use this image and create a new virtual machine from it. So we go the standard route, compute virtual machine from gallery. Now we go to my images and we have the new Azure Linux generalized image available. Let's type in a machine name. Let's call it Azure Linux Gen from generalized. Select D1 as the machine size. And unlike the specialized image virtual machine creation process, we now can create the root, change the root username and password. We'll stick with the Azure username. But we'll provide a different password this time from the one that was used in the machine we created from. However, when it comes to region limitations, you will still only have the option of creating that virtual machine in the same region as the image. So when it comes to Microsoft endorsed images, you can create, as you can see, as you've seen actually, you can create the machine in any region. When it comes to your own images, whether it's a specialized image or a generalized image, you can only select the region from which the in which the storage account of the image is in. Okay, let's select a virtual network from within that region and open the HTTP port as well. Good, and we'll leave this as is. Now, while the machine is created, let's go to images and see a few information about this image. So this is the label, the description we provided when creating the image. You can see the information about when the image was created, when it was modified. You can also see the name of the machine from which this image was created. But what's more important is that if you look at here at the VHD section, you'll see that an image is not just a generalized or a reusable disk. It can actually contain more disks. So in our case, we have, because the machine had 3 disks, once we created the image, this image contains all those 3 disks. So we have the operating system disk. It says that it's an OS, it's Linux running inside it, and that it's a generalized image, meaning that I can change the SSH details, the authentication details, DNS server details, and so forth. It's 40 gigabytes in size. You can see the host cache option that was enabled for that machine. And we also have the 2 data disks that we attach to the machine. So when we create the new machine from this image, we should have 3 disks attached to the machine. Please note that these are not the same disks as the ones that were attached to the machine we created the image from. Each time you create a machine from this image, it will have 3 disks attached to it, disks that are almost in every sense identical to the ones from the original machine, but these will be new disks. Okay, so we've seen this, and you can see that each of these disks, part of the image, are stored in a blob. So let's go ahead, while the machine is still creating, let's go ahead and look at these blobs. Okay. One second. Looks like there isn't. There we go. There's a small error there. Good. So we have these three parts of the image. We have the OS part of the image and the data disks. When you look at it, there is basically no difference between a disk and an image in terms of the way it's stored in Azure Storage. You can also, let's go to the Azure Storage storage account and see how these are exposed. So we have to use the Azure MySQL VM storage account, then the VHDs container. Good. And finally, we'll have to look for the blobs that start with Azure Linux Generalized Image. So there we go, we have these three blobs. If you look at the properties, they're almost identical to a disk. And that's because in terms of the way it's stored as a blob, there's no difference between a disk and an image. Now, let's go back to the virtual machines and see the state the machine is in. So we have, there we go, we have the virtual machine started for us. The next thing we're going to do is first take a look at this machine and make sure that all the three disks were attached to the machine. And sure enough, there we go, the OS disks and the two data disks. And next, why not use these disks and create a software disk array from it. Let's say that we have a database that wants to store 2 terabytes of data. Because the limitation on the data disk is 1 terabyte, what you normally have to do is split the data files for your database on these two data disks. But there are certain databases that do not allow you to have this data split. So what you have to do is somehow come up with an option of having the disks bundled together and be exposed as a single drive. And this is achievable by using a software RAID array. Another benefit of using such disk striping technology is allowing you to have better performance per disk. So by using striping for 2 disks, you can have access to 2 times the performance of a single disk. So in order to do that, let's first connect via SSH to this newly created machine. So I'll start my SSH client and say I want a new connection. I'll use the hostname now for connecting to it. Let's see what the SSH port is. Looks like it's 22 for this machine. Please note that when creating a machine, Azure might use a random port, a random public port for SSH, and type in the SSH credentials that I selected when creating the machine, and let's now attempt to connect. There we go. We're provided with the certificate and the thumbprint. The thumbprint that's provided to you when connected via SSH should be the same as the one in the portal here. So if this is a production machine and you want to make sure you're connecting to the same machine, please compare the thumbprints with the ones in the portal. Okay, now let's go in sudo mode, super user mode, and look at the disks again. So we have the disks and the partitions that we created on top of them. One thing you probably note is that previously we mounted both SDC and SDD on 2 folders. So SDC was in /data here, and SDD was mounted in /data2. Why Linux didn't automatically mount them for us? Because in order to have the disks automatically mounted, when the machine starts, you have to do it in, you have to make some changes in the etc fs tab file. So I'm just going to show you a preview. There we go, we already have two disks here. So the first one is the operating system disk. You have the ID of the operating system disk mounted in the root folder of the file system, and it's an X4 file system, and these are some mounting options. And then we also have the dev sdb1, which is a temporary drive that's by default mounted in mnt/mnt. So if you want to have your data disks automatically mounted in a folder, you should also add those disks here. We're not going to go through that process now, but you can find pretty good documentation on the internet on how to do this. It's pretty simple. My single recommendation is please use the unique IDs for when mounting via fstab. You can find out the unique IDs of each device by just issuing the blk ID command. There we go, we have the this one for SDC and this ID for SDD. Good, now let's go ahead and create the software array, software disk array. Let's close this first and go through the process. So the first thing we need to do is to have the application that's used to create the striping, the disk array, and that's called MDADM. By default, this is installed on most recent Linux distributions. We'll just go ahead and check it. It looks like it's not installed here. We'll go and select no configuration for this instance. And it should be done in about a minute. Let's walk through the other steps. So the next step is we just want to tell the MDADM application to create the array for us. We'll have to provide a device name for this array that will be created. The convention is to put the device, of course, in slash dev. And the prefix is MD, followed by a number. Usually it's between 0 and 127. Then you'll have to provide the RAID level that you want to emulate using this application. We'll stick with level 0, which is just striping. You can also have level 1, which is mirroring. You can have level 5 and level 1 plus 0 as well. Then we'll have to specify the number of devices that we want to include in this RAID array. Because we have two data disks, we'll specify two devices. The chunk size for each device, and then we'll tell it which devices should be included in the RAID array. In our case, it's DevSDC and DevSDD, the two data disks. Let's go ahead. Okay, looks like this is ready. Let's issue the command. It should be almost instant. It says that these two disks are already used because they have a partition on top of it. Do you want to continue creating the array? Yes. And now the array was started. Good. Next step, we want to create, first let's actually format the disk and create a partition on top of this new array. Let's call it, I think it's devmd0, yes. And we'll say we want a new partition, we want to make it primary, it will span the entire disk. And let's write the changes. Good, so this is done. Let's issue as blk again. And there we go, we have SDC and SDD. Both point to MD0, so they're both part of this software disk array. And if you look at type, it says that it's a RAID 0 array. And then under this device, you have single partition, the one we just created. And the size of this partition is 2 terabytes. So we already achieved what our target was, to have a disk that's 2 terabytes in size that can hold our database, because the database data files were larger than 1 terabyte. Good. Next step, Let's go ahead and create a file system on top of this partition, and then mount the drive in our file system. In my case, I'm going to create, I'll go for X4 because this is probably the best option at the moment for this Linux distribution or Ubuntu. The file system block size is by default 4 kilos, so I'll leave it like that. And these are some software array options that you can get the best values for using a calculator that will be provided in the materials for this course. And I'll specify that I want to create the file system on top of the first partition on the software array. Let's do this. Okay. Now it's going to write the super blocks and the accounting information. It's done. Let's look at... actually, let's just mount it. We have the data folder, right? There's nothing in it now. And let's mount the partition in data. Great. Let's issue a df now. And there we go. We have dev slash md0 partition 1, 2 terabytes in size, mounted in slash data with roughly 1.9 terabytes available to you. If we go to slash data, we'll have the default lost and found that's created when mounting the device. There we go. Now we have a software array running on top of a Linux virtual machine. You can create as many software arrays as you want per machine. You can also add pretty much as many disks as you want for one array. Please note that you have the disk limitation in Azure, which is 2 times the number of cores. And this is pretty much it. When creating a RAID 0 array, though, you have to keep in mind that if you lose one of the disks for some reason, you will not be able to recover the data pretty much at all. So be careful how you manage your disks. When you create such a software array, it's good that you have backups from time to time. This was about it for the images and the software array part. Let's go back and see our next service, which is Azure Files. Now, before diving into the Azure File service, let's first take a look at the Azure Storage Service Framework. So, at the top here, we have multiple specialized storage services like Azure Blobs, which are used both by virtual machines to store persistent disks, and also by Azure service users that want to serve files, for instance, for internet websites. Second service is a table service, a highly scalable and persistent NoSQL data store. And then we also have, again, a highly scalable and persistent queue service. One property we emphasized so far is that all the services are highly scalable, and that's because they are built on a layer of massive scalability and auto load balancing. This means that there are a lot of storage servers, hosting these dedicated services, and whenever the need arises, this intermediary layer will scale the service for you automatically. The lowest layer for the Azure Storage Service Framework is a distributed replication layer, which guarantees that your data will be persistent with multiple copies. And additionally, if you go for the geo-replication persistence option, it will also replicate the data to a paired region for you. Now, the service we'll be focusing on for this last part of the module is called Azure File Share. One limitation of Azure disks that we already pointed out is that you can only attach the disk to a single machine. There are lots of scenarios where you need to share a disk, and you need to share the information from that disk in real time with other machines. In Azure, there is this file share service that allows you to attach a disk to multiple machines and read and write from it using the SMB protocol. Of course, if you need to use the file share from outside, you also have a REST protocol, a REST endpoint available, so that you can actually write files to the share or read files from the share, even from an internet endpoint. Now, let's look at the service a bit closer. Let's say you have multiple IaaS VMs and also a cloud service running Windows Server. So you have three Linux instances and a Windows machine running as a cloud service. If you want to share the information between these machines, what you would normally do is either use a dedicated storage service and use an SDK right to that service, and then read from it from the other instances. But the issue with this approach is that you don't actually have access to a lot of file system operations. So if you use a third party tool that can only write to the file service, to the file system, you won't be able to make it point, at least not easily, to make it point to your file share. Ideally, you'd have the service that is compatible with existing protocols and that also plugs into the machine as a file system, and that's exactly what Azure File Share does. It's just a shared network file storage system. It's built for Azure, but it relies on the SMB protocol that's pretty common even outside cloud services. And as we've already mentioned, it has two interfaces, the SMB protocol and also REST protocol that we'll also be using today, which allows you to see the contents of the file share from outside Azure. A few scenarios. Of course, the main macro scenario is that you need to share files between machines, but there may be multiple reasons why you want to share files. One of them is if you want to share settings for an application. Let's say you have an application cluster of maybe 100 machines and you want to deploy a configuration change to all the machines. The hardest way to approach this would be to just log in to each machine and make a configuration change. A bit easier though is to just version the contents of this configuration file and then deploy the changes to each machine, but using the configuration versioning client. But even easier than that, you can just put the configuration file on an Azure File Share, and then once you make the change, it will be propagated instantly to all the machines in that cluster. Other scenarios where you might use the Azure File Share is maybe if you have, let's say, some large volume of files that you want to deploy at the same time to all the machines. Even using a version control system, this would take a long time because you'd have to do it on each machine. Using Azure Files, you'll just do it once. And finally, if you can go use it for a dev test and debug scenarios. Let's actually go to the portal and create one of these file shares. Okay, so let's log into the portal. And look at the commands that we have to issue in order to create such a file share. For this demonstration, I'll be using PowerShell. You can do the same either using the cross-platform command line tools if you're developing on Linux or Mac.
I won't go into detail on how you can set up Azure PowerShell because that's the purpose of another module. But what I will cover is how to create the file share using PowerShell. The first thing we need to do is first create a storage account or use an existing storage account to create a file share on top of. Please note one thing. You can share a storage account for multiple storage services. So for instance, as we've seen, we already use the Azure MySQL VM storage account to store disks. You can also use it to create a file share on top of it, but because storage accounts are free, I'll just create a new one. I like to have each of the services have a dedicated storage account. So we'll go to storage, quick create, and let's call it Linux share. Okay, Linux share works. We'll go with West Europe as the location, and we'll go for Azure redundant as the replication type. Now, while this is created, let's take a look at the commands that we have to issue in order to create a file share. There we go. So we have some user mean, yeah. First, we need to create an Azure storage context. This is like authentication for a storage account. And then we need to create a Azure storage share. And we'll, as a parameter, we'll give it the share name and the authentication context. Okay, now let's see if the storage account was created. It's still creating. Okay, let's refresh the portal. It should be done in a few seconds. Usually creating a storage account takes about a minute, even less than a minute. Let's start typing the commands. Unfortunately, we cannot issue the commands until we have the storage account because we need the account name and the account key properties. Okay, so there we go, we have it. Now, the first piece of information we'll take is the account name, which is just Linux share. And then we'll take the one of the access keys, so I'll use the secondary access key to create the context in PowerShell. Okay, we have the context. Now, let's go ahead and create the storage share in this context. So this has two parameters I've already pointed out. We'll call it Linux share. Please note that this does not have to be the same as the storage account name. This is just a coincidence. Okay, let's create the share. Share was created for us. Now, let's see if we can get the information about this share. Oops, I forgot to provide the context. Okay. There we go. So we have the endpoint that we need to connect to in case we want to use the REST endpoint. And we also, it's also mentioned that we have this Linux share share created for us. You can create additional shares on top of the same files endpoint if you want to. Now, let's go to the machine, one of the machines, and first we have to start it. But then we'll need to actually connect this share to both of the machines. I'll start both of them now. And then see how the contents of the share are synchronized between them. I've also connected via SSH to each of them. Now, one prerequisite for using Azure Files is the SIFS Utils application. This is installed by default for most recent Linux distributions. In this case, I'm using an Ubuntu 14.04, which has SIFSutils already installed. If you're using another distribution, you have to install it manually by either apt-get install sysutils or a yum install sysutils. So we have this ready on both machines. Next, we'll have to mount the file share using the mount command. Let's just take a closer look now. So we'll issue a mount. We'll specify sys as the file system type, and then we'll need to input the name of the storage account we just created. I've already added the file share name. Then you'll have to mention where you want it mounted on the local file system. Then we'll say it's using the 2.1 SMB protocol, and we'll also have to provide it with the authentication details. For Azure files, the username is the storage account name, so the same as the one used in the endpoint. And as a password, we'll have to input the storage account key. And the file share will be mounted with 777 as the mask for both directories and files, meaning everyone will have access to the file share. Okay, let's go to the portal, to the storage account, and we'll first take the account name and put it as both the endpoint and the username, and go to access keys again, copy the secondary access key, and paste it in the connection details. Let's issue the command now in the machine. First, we'll need to create the directory where we want to upload, where we want to mount the file share. Let's call it slash share in the root directory. So mkdir slash share. Let's see if this works. Okay, so there it is. We have this slash share folder created. You can see that everyone can read write to it, meaning that the mount was successful. Now, in order to test it, we should probably just create a file. Okay, let's create it using nano, so we can also edit the contents. We'll call it fs-test.txt. Hello from machine one. Now, we'll go to the second machine, go to the root folder, see that there is no slash share folder, right? We'll also create it. Please note that you can have the share mounted on a different folder in each machine, but in this case we'll just go with the same folder. Okay, we'll also go now in this folder. See, there's nothing in it, just like here. So the folder was created as a regular folder in the file system. Let's get the connection string again, paste it, go to the share, and there we go. As you can see, it has the contents that we created on machine one. Let's also edit it. We'll say hello from machine two. Now we'll also go there, and the contents were changed in real time. Now, as with disks, when you restart the machine, or if it's restarted for you automatically by Azure, the share will not be mounted. You'll have to do it manually again. One way to make sure that either disks or shares are mounted automatically is to edit the fs tab file. We've taken a look at this a bit earlier, but in the case of the file share, we'll actually go ahead and edit the file in this session. So let's go here. First of all, let's unmount the share. Sorry. First, we have to get out of that directory using the command line. So the share is unmounted, as you can see. Now, let's go to the FS tab and edit it so that the share is automatically mounted when the machine is started. The syntax is similar to what we've used when mounting. So first of all, you need to specify the endpoint of the share. Then you'll have to specify where it needs to be mounted, in our case in slash share. Then you need to specify the file system and the option, which is just the version of the SMB protocol, the file and directory mask, and then also the credentials that we provided previously. So let's take the username again and the password. Now copy this. Oops. Oh, probably worked. Okay, let's copy it again. Okay, and now, in order to make sure that it works, let's say mount minus a, which is just mount all. And here we go. We have the share mounted, and we have the file in it with the contents we created. So this is it for Azure Files. Now, before we end this session, let's take a final look at some of the properties of Azure Storage. We'll focus on performance this time. So, when you create operating system disk by creating the machine, the performance you can expect is around 300 IOPS per OS disk. Any data disk that you add for the machine will provide you around 500 IOPS. If you proceed to create a software RAID array, as we have in this session, you'll probably get linear performance increase. So two data disks in a RAID 0 setup will be 1000 IOPS, four data disks 2000 IOPS, and so forth. Now, there's a different storage account type called premium storage that only works with disks, with VM disks. So you cannot have tables, queues, block blobs on top of it, at least not as of now. And that provides even better for performance. Depending on the disk size, you can get anywhere from 500 to 5,000 IOPS per disk. 500 IOPS is for the smaller disks, and you get 5,000 IOPS as soon as you hit the 1 terabyte mark. So these are the persistent disk types. There is one thing I did not mention here, which is that the Azure File Share at this point provides roughly 1,000 IOPS. Finally, there are the ephemeral disks, so the disks that have contents erased, have their contents erased whenever the machine is restarted or moved to a different physical host. For the A-series machines, you have HDD-backed ephemeral disks. The performance of these disks is volatile, so it fluctuates. You can get anywhere from a few hundred IOPS, maybe up to 2000 IOPS, at least from what we've seen so far. And for D-series and G-series machines, you have SSD-backed drives. These are significantly faster and can go anywhere from a few thousand IOPS, maybe 2,000 to 3,000, all the way to several tens of thousands of IOPS. Okay, and with this being said, this is it for this module. See you in the next module.